Hi, Xander here, editor of the podcast. Just wanted to make a quick announcement that next week, that's Wednesday, October 21st, there will not be an episode of the I Read Comic Books podcast. Now, don't worry, we're not ending the podcast. We're just scheduling a little break and telling you it close to the last possible minute. Sorry. We'll be back on for the following weeks, starting again on October 28th, and we'll try to keep you apprised of our schedule in the future. We'll still be reachable at the show's email, that's cyborg@destroythecybe.org, as well as on social media. Our handles can be found in the show notes. Shoot us a message. Chat with us about comics. Tell us what you're reading. Anyways, that's about it. Enjoy the show.
This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg. With me this week are two fabulous people, Nick White, staff contributor for comics at Destroy the Cyborg, and Paul Jaisley, staff editor and contributor for comic books. Thank you guys for joining me in this late edition of the podcast. I say late edition simply because we're recording a day late, and this may be coming out a day later than usual. But how have you guys been? How are comics?
Well, comics are good. I actually had some free time this weekend, so I actually read a whole stack of comics, which is kind of rare for me these days, it seems. So I made a big dent in my ever-growing stack of monthly books. A couple that really stood out for me were Paper Girls number 1, which I reviewed for the site, so I'll leave my thoughts there so you can read them. Suffice to say, I really, really enjoyed it. Justice League number 44, again, I'm really digging the big Darkseid War storyline, as kind of dumb as it can be sometimes. The idea of Darkseid and the Anti-Monitor just duking it out, it's hard not to get into that. Transformers vs. G.I. Joe number 9.
Paul, or?
No, that was still Fabuc on art. So, very good issue again. I'm digging that. Still big superhero action that I apparently have a sweet tooth for sometimes.
Yeah.
Transformers versus G.I. Joe number 9 was fantastic, as always. I don't want to spoil anything, but I absolutely loved it. Yeah, so good. I got to mention Martian Manhunter and Black Canary. The fourth issue of both those books came out recently, and those are series that I really liked the first issue so much, and they had such a strong hook that I kind of like found the second and third issues a little bit lacking. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I get that specifically about Martian Manhunter.
Yeah. I thought the fourth issues of both these series were like nice resettings or like realignment, sort of like a reminder of what the book's about. Martian Manhunter number 4 has adds another like twist to the premise that's really interesting. I don't want to give too much away, but it explores the idea that there might be more than one Martian Manhunter.
I mean, just Martian, right? I mean,
More than one Martian Manhunter. There's like different,
because like he's supposed to be the last Martian, right?
Right.
Oh, but outside his niece. If you haven't read the book, the story. But, oh no, there's way more to that, I think.
Yeah, but I guess, you know what? I'm going to spoil it. Screw it. The issue implies.
Hold on, I got to cross this trade off my read list. Just okay, give me a second.
Sorry. The issue implies that there's not just more than one Martian Manhunter. There's multiple characters that represent different parts of his psyche. So there's like there's one character that's like a cop, that's like a noble like hero guy, and then like the character they introduced in the first issue, Mr. Biscuits, is the character, the part of him that loves Oreo cookies. What? So it's like his psyche split among different people. It's really, really clever. I really liked it.
Are you saying he dips into these different personalities, or that each one of these has its own physical presence separate of...
There's a line in the book where someone basically says you're thinking of it in terms of like a human consciousness, but it's Martian, it's different. Mm. Like it's different.
Right. So it's different.
Different concept of identity, more or less.
It sounds like they're tapping into that whole, I mean, you would know way more than me, but I know with Martian Manhunter, there's been a long history of, like, whenever he's been reinvented, he sort of has a different human persona that he tends to gravitate to. And I don't...
Yeah.
I mean, so it sounds like maybe they're getting at some of that.
It's really interesting. I'm really liking that. It was a nice sort of reminder of why I dug the series with the first issue. Same thing with Black Canary number 4. And then, of course, I made it to the library, which means I checked out some interesting books. I have a habit of just grabbing random books, which can sometimes lead to some interesting comparisons. I grabbed The Playboy by Chester Brown. I think I'd mentioned another book of his I'd read a few weeks ago, Paying for It, which is about him visiting prostitutes. The Playboy is about him collecting Playboys as a teenager and includes, you know, the activities he did while reading Playboy.
And, okay.
I can't wait for his shortest graphic novel entitled The PG Events of My Life.
Yeah, exactly. And then the book Spent by Joe Matt, which is a book that chronicles the author's struggle with pornography addiction. So I somehow managed to check out two different books that were about masturbating or the masturbatory habits of the authors, which was interesting. And then
I'm sure it was a coincidence.
Did you use the self-checkout or did you have some clerk?
Oh, always self-checkout.
Yeah.
I started using the self-checkout when I was checking out volumes of Empowered from the library. I was like, thank God there's a self-checkout.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then, so two more to mention real quick. Empire State by Jason Shiga. I mentioned him before a couple episodes ago because I've been reading his book Demon, his webcomic, and loving it. This was another sort of just amazing book by him. It's, again, so sort of semi-autobiographical about this guy who takes a Greyhound bus from Oakland to New York to visit his unrequited love. It's a weird skewering of sort of romantic comedy tropes, but the way Jason Shiga like paces the story, he's got a really unique way of doing page layouts, which gives the book a really unique rhythm. Just fantastic stuff. Just very, very clever. The way it tells a simple story in a very clever, unique way, I really, really dug. Shiga's stuff I'm really enjoying these days. And probably the highlight of my week, which I'm sure you guys could, you know me enough to know that I dig this book. Kentucky Fried Chicken presents The Colonel of Two Worlds, starring The Flash and Colonel Sanders. This is a.
I'm not going to make fun of it because, like, when we're done, I'm going to read it.
You're going
to
read it.
I saw this on Comixology, so I'll just wanted to cry.
I'll avoid spoilers.
Yes, please. I must read it. It's a free book. I mean, I have to now.
I hope there's canon. A part of you that this thought better be
I
was, canon.
I know that Nick, it is canon because it's a one shot, 20-page free comic on Comixology, written by Tony Bedard. And the premise is that Captain Cold and the Mirror Master meet up with the Colonel Sanders of Earth 3, who, of course, we know because he's from Earth 3, is the opposite of the real Colonel Sanders. So he's lazy and evil. So he opens up a chicken restaurant, fried chicken restaurant, that does everything half-assed and like sloppily and doesn't try very hard, does things the easy way. And he's ruining the Colonel's reputation. So the Colonel shows him that he teams up with the Flash and the Green Lantern to show people that you have to do things the hard way if you want good results. So as a 20-page advertisement for a fried chicken franchise, I actually kind of enjoyed it.
Oh, man.
Evil chicken? Is that what I heard? Sorry.
Doesn't he have like some wonderfully like evil variation on, isn't he like called like Colonel? It's like something else, but it's clearly
General
like
Sanders.
No, it's like one of those swap out names you usually get. I don't know. It sounds like the most productive Hal Jordan's been in years, so I'm...
I will say I've always been a sucker for these kind of things, like these blatant advertisements. I liked this not because I like Kentucky Fried Chicken, but I liked it because it was just sort of a funny spoof on not just advertising, but also just the idea of there being parallel Earths. It's obviously a spoof of the classic Flash of Two Worlds story, so I don't know, for free... I got 5 minutes worth of enjoyment out of it. So, comics. There you go.
Jeez. Right. Anything's possible. Nick, what was on your plate? What'd you read this week?
Oh, man. Ugh. I went on Comixology, and I really shouldn't be on there without a supervised adult anymore. Or maybe, like, there needs to be a feature where it asks me, like, 9 times... And I have to solve one of those, like, alphanumeric puzzles, and I have to put the Rubik's Cube back in place and answer some, like, questions, security questions about who was in my second grade social studies class, and then it finally lets me buy things. I think that would be a really good idea, because I was on there, and I think they had, like, 8 sales running this weekend. So, to be fair, I think I did pretty well, all things considered. It could have been a lot worse, but the top shelf sale was really, really good. So I got Super Spy by Matt Kent and the Lost Dossiers. That is how you say it, right? It is Dossiers. It's not Dossiers.
Yeah.
Okay. And also picked up all of Jeff Lemire's Essex County, which it's like, God, it was like 540 pages. And I read some of that just in the blink of an eye without even thinking about it. And that was really, really good. I also got around to finally reading volumes 5 and 6 of Unity. Volume 6 was really, really good. There were some new artists on that. I honestly can't remember their names, but it was one of those really neat back and forth sort of past versus present events with an artist designated to each for the whole arc, which I've always thought that was kind of cool. Arc 6 was called Warmonger, and it's about this girl who, they're a little bit vague about it, but seemingly like her dad was a demon. They don't elaborate much. She's like, my dad was like a real asshole or whatever, and she's got like a really bad potty mouth for like the whole arc. She's just swearing nonstop, but of course Valiant doesn't really like, you know, dropping the F-bomb, so it's just nonstop, you know, whatever they call those symbols all the time when they don't want to swear.
Expletive, like symbol. Like.
Right, there is a technical term for those, and I'm not, it's not even on the tip of my tongue, but you just get those all the time, which is really hilarious. It was an interesting book. It's this idea that much like the Eternal Warrior is like, has lived forever, and his goal is to protect the Earth, like, she's also immortal, and she's lived forever, but her idea is to sort of be the one who incites discontent, and the one who basically, as her name suggests, as Warmonger, brings about all these different conflicts. And so Matt Kent has a lot of fun injecting her into quite a few different places in history, from I think the days of the bubonic plague to the Crusades. Has a lot of fun with it. I really, really enjoyed that. Beyond that, I also read Omega Men 3 and 4, which was really interesting, because 4 actually had a guest artist, so that was the first time we've had one of those. I thought they did a pretty good job. Fortunately, can't think of their name, but I will say, if you're not reading Omega Men, it is absolutely fantastic. I would
Nick's
say
the reason why DC didn't cancel that book.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd love to know what, I mean, I'd love to say that maybe DC wasn't reading their own book, and then when everyone's like, how dare you cancel it, you know, Jim Lee and Dan Didio were like, fuck, what's Omega Men, what is this, and they're like, that's one of your books, they're like, we don't read that shit.
And then, I'm sure that's what happened. I'm sure.
That's exactly what happened.
Look, I talked with Rich Johnson over at Bleeding Cool, and he assured me that this is how it played out. I'm kidding, but no, it's really good. I really like it because it is a story that, unlike a lot of, and I don't want to stereotype big two books too much, but unlike a lot of big two books.
No more than we usually do.
Yeah, no more than we usually do. This book is totally okay with being a mystery that is going to naturally unfold, and it doesn't matter how many times you reread the issue from front to back, or how many times you go back and read the past two or three issues, it's still going to remain a mystery. And I feel like that's something that's lost in modern day comics, where it's like, don't worry, we're going to hold your hand the whole way. And if you don't understand everything, that's not because we didn't intentionally keep information from you. It's there. Just go back and reread it, or we'll recap it real soon. And again, that's a minor soapbox moment for me, and you can agree or disagree. But I feel like books that, you know, intentionally create a really good sense of mystery and sort of put the reader in the dark and keep the reader there for a prolonged period of time, they're sort of gone. And I mean, sure, it's a little bit hoity-toity. It does love sort of the 9-panel thing, which I think isn't that sort of a Kirby thing?
It looked like more of a like a Watchmen thing, because I think Kirby usually did 6 panels.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's got that going on, and the last panel of every issue is like a quote, and I think there's been one or two William Blake quotes, which it's like, okay, we get it, you've read literature, but they're well-placed quotes, and it's a nice thing to sort of meditate on at the end of the issue. So read it.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to. I feel like you're going to beat me over the head with a baseball bat if I don't at this point. So
well, you know, Xander and I were at Vault a couple weeks ago, and just picking up some extra stuff, and they still had a number one, and I just gave it to him and said, you need to read it, and I guess he's all caught up now. So, I mean, nice. There you have it.
Nice.
Endorsement by proxy. So what about you, Mike? Have you had time? I mean, I listened to all these stories about you gallivanting all over town and just generally becoming a more cultured individual, which that's great. But the question is, did it leave you any time to actually read anything?
Oh, well, let me just say that last week was like a blur in terms of like, as soon as Monday started, I was ready for it to be Thursday, because New York Comic Con was this past weekend, for those of you who may not have known. So on Thursday, I was like dead set to go to the con. I was supposed to take the day off, and I forgot to put in time properly, blah, blah, blah. So I left at about 4 o'clock, and I went to the con for about 3 hours, and I was wasted afterwards, like just physically exhausted afterwards. I didn't drink anything. I walked around so hard that I just wanted to die afterwards. I went home, slept, woke up early the next day, went to the con. I mean, so I guess let me backpedal a little bit. I did go to the comic shop. I did pick up Jughead number one. I did pick up Paper Girls and a handful of others, but I didn't read anything I read except for Paper Girls. And I was in the middle of reading the Royals trade paperback, which I was able to finish while waiting in line for an Image panel. So that's what I read this past week. Paper Girls is fantastic. If you haven't grabbed it, go find a copy. It is so cool. It is not what I expected it to be at all. There was the first 30 pages, I was like, cool, cool, cool. This is just 80s. I love 80s. 80s is
does
fun.
Does it get like sort
nice
of dark
retro
slice of life, or does it take a weird supernatural sort of, or something like that? I mean, you can be
will
super
not
vague.
Spoil
I'm
just, it.
Oh, great. Well, damn it. Now I'm going to have to wait for the trade or something.
Yeah, Nick. Just to have Cliff Chang's art. I think we talked about this last week. Like, just to have Cliff Chang's art in my life is great. And then the actual story is very good. And then, of course, so at New York Comic Con, the one panel that I did manage to make it into was this Image Creators First something or other about hyping Image comic books, because, you know, I don't know if you guys knew this, but they do creator-owned books.
Oh, interesting, interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty new. I only say that because I feel like it's constantly being pushed in our faces. But anyways, to hear Brian K. Vaughan and Cliff Chang talk about the book was awesome. Like, their reasoning behind the way that they crafted the first issue was just splendid. And it spoils the book, so I don't want to go too far into it, but it's such a fantastic read. But so I didn't read a lot, and instead I went to New York City Comic Con Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. I ended up skipping on Sunday to go to a concert in New Jersey because Coheed and Cambria was playing, and they're awesome. But anyways, yeah, so I went to the con. I met I met a bunch of creators, and I just was like, hey, hello, please sign my comic books, and then awkwardly walked away. I got some sketches done, and creators refused to let me pay for them. Not to say they were like, don't you fucking pay me money, but yeah. It was more like, no, 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 you don't have to. So instead I like bought merch because, you know, I wanted to somehow give them money for the very nice thing that they did for me. So I got a sketch, really nice sketch done by Valentine DeLandro, who's on Bitch Planet. Nick Dragata did a really quick sketch and wouldn't let me pay him money. He was just happy that I was supporting East of West. I got a sketch done by Clayton Henry, and he wasn't too pleased about it because, I don't know, oh. It was weird. He wasn't rude to me or anything like that, but I was like, hey, man, can I get a sketch? Because I got a book signed by him, and he was like, this isn't what this line is for, but sure, so he did it anyways. So he was very nice about it. And let's see, I got one other sketch by Matt Kent. Oh, yeah, little known creator named Matt Kent did a sketch, and I bought a copy of Secret Spy hardcover.
I'll never know when you get it wrong intentionally anymore. We're at that point. We've reached that point.
Yeah,
we're never
for
gonna
the last the last like 3 days I've been telling Nick, hey man, I got a copy of Super Spy, and he's like, Mike, that's not the name of the book. It's Secret Spy.
That is the name of the book.
I don't know anymore. I don't know. I'm telling you, I'm just wiped by the con. I'm just out of it. So I've officially gotten the con sickness, so that's why I'm a little nasally and scratch throaty. And I also scream my lungs out at this concert. So it's been a very interesting couple days for me. So
So what you're saying is you really didn't read anything, and you probably could have, you know, gotten to that point minutes ago. But right.
Yeah, yeah. But I just, you know, I had to rub it in everyone's face that I went to New York Comic Con, all that jazz.
I wasn't going to use that sort of language when discussing it, but I mean, if you want, all right, great.
It's
so for those keeping score, Mike had a great time. I went on Comixology, and that was a mistake. And Paul, because he's a well-functioning adult, went to the library and then quite subversively checked out questionable materials. So yeah. For those keeping score, Mike's still ahead.
He still wins, I think.
Other than the fact that Paul is using public resources to read X-rated material. So, I mean, maybe
there's
it's a
whole
a tie.
Episode of Parks and Rec about this. It's yeah. Fine. Just go watch that episode and I'll clear everything up for you.
Oh, man. Well, my pick this week is Twilight Children number one, and I cannot wait. Basically, the best way I can sell it is just by naming the creative team. It's written by Gilbert Hernandez of Love and Rockets fame, with yep. art by Darwin Cook.
I don't know who that is, but I mean...
You know the reputation, at least.
I know you talk about Love and Rockets. I mean, you can just sell the other name to oblivion with me, so I don't even right. care.
Who yeah. Wait, who else is on this book?
Well, the art is by Darwin Cook. And
oh,
the
okay.
Colors by Dave Smith. Dave Stewart, sorry, Dave Stewart.
Oh, I didn't know he... Oh, sweet. So, I didn't know Stewart was on this. Stewart's great.
Yeah, I mean, the book kind of sells itself, but I'm very excited because, I mean, these are huge names in comic books. Whether you're familiar with Love and Rockets or not, Gilbert Hernandez is a massive, massive, you know, influence on a lot of people. He's been doing comics for 30 years. His series in Love and Rockets is called Palomar. He has a couple different series, but his main one is Palomar, which is about this town in Mexico. And it has this sort of magical realism sort of feel to it, where it's just like a weird Twin Peaks-y sort of magical place in Mexico. And this book seems to be similar to that. It's about a little village. These kids in the village find a glowing orb and somehow it gives them powers or changes them somehow. Cool. So it's right in his wheelhouse story-wise, but I've seen some of the preview images and Darwin Cook, man, he can draw anything, you know? And he yeah. kind of nails that surreal, magical, the strangeness of the ordinary that Hernandez kind of does in his writing. Darwin Cook is fantastic at that. And again, Dave Stewart, as a guy who just, as we become more and more accustomed or acknowledging of the importance of colorists, Dave Stewart's one of the best out there. So this book is going to look beautiful. I'm very excited for it. It's a 4-issue miniseries from Vertigo. So yeah, I cannot wait. These are, like I said, titans of the industry working together for the first time. It's awesome, exciting stuff.
So does Gilbert Hernandez normally draw his own books? Or does he usually work? Doesn't he usually work with Jaime Hernandez, his brother?
Well, see, geez, Mike, haven't you read Love and Rockets? Haven't you read all 30 years worth of books?
You know, it's funny you say that. I'm actually in the middle of reading Maggie the Mechanic right now. Okay. But anyways.
So Love and Rockets was the name of the book that the two brothers published together. They each did their own stories, each wrote and draw their own stories. So Maggie the Mechanic, Loca's stories, which is, I've read all of that. That's Jaime Hernandez, and that's kind of like one continuous story.
Gotcha. Okay.
Gilbert Hernandez does like a bunch of different stuff. He did the Palomar stories. He has sort of a longer continuing narrative about a family that's moved out of the city. But he also does like a ton of, that guy publishes like three books a year. I mean, he just does OGNs constantly, and he all draws it himself. So it's interesting to see him work with a different artist. And one that you wouldn't normally associate with this type of story. So that's what also makes it interesting, is just to see how it's going to translate to him writing for somebody else to draw.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Nick, what's on your plate for this week?
Well, I was actually, gosh, I feel like it's going to be Twilight Children now, even though, unfortunately, Twilight Children just happened. It was one of those things where it just happened to be in the previews catalog where there were like three other things that were sort of on lock. So... normally I'd say I'll pick that up and trade, but I don't really know how a Vertigo miniseries is going to end up. Well, I hope it ends up in trade. Otherwise, there's another trip to Comixology. I'll have to pencil that in. Here we go. This episode is brought to you by Comixology, because clearly I've said their name enough times at this point that you really ought to be giving me money, because Lord only knows it sounds like I'm going to be giving you some. So for me, it's going to be Justice League United 14. I think this is probably the first time I've ever picked this book. But this issue is going to be fantastic. There was a note. Yeah, let's say it. There's no way this issue is going to be bad. It's got a Tony Harris cover, which no matter how you feel about Tony Harris's personal views on stuff, I think cosplaying was the real touchy subject, my memory serves me correctly. His art is super distinctive, and it is really interesting to look at. So we're going to have a Tony Harris cover. We're going to have a guest artist in Paul Pelletier, who's most recently doing Aquaman. Still might be doing Aquaman with... Oh, wait, you know what? I think Aquaman is Trevor McCarthy now. Yes. But pre-DCU, he was doing Aquaman with Jeff Parker, which I guess technically this issue is a reunion of that team then, because it's Jeff Parker writing and Paul Pelletier on art. Anyway, Justice League United has recently been regarded as the new Justice League Dark, and what I mean by that is that anything that they realize that there are fans out there that are very passionate about it, but they don't want to have it have its own book, or they recently shuttered whatever book these characters were in, Justice League United is the new dumping ground for all that weird crap. And apparently they've decided, or Jeff Parker's decided, to really flip the switch to 11, because this issue is going to have Sergeant Rock from G.I. Combat, it's going to have Robot Man from Doom Patrol, it's going to have Vandal Savage from a whole bunch of things, because he's immortal, so he shows up in a lot of stuff. They're like, you know what, we don't care, it's going to get weird. And considering the book only has about two more issues, I'm sure Dan Didio's like, yeah, that's fine, get as weird as you want, because in December, I can tell you what's going to happen. So, yeah, well, Justice League United, man, weird as hell.
I've been meaning to pick this up, and you just said the two words that'll make me pick up any DC book, and that's Doom Patrol.
Doom Patrol.
So, yeah, I'm going to have to grab this issue. Yeah.
This sounds like some weird, like, this sounds like a weird Grant Morrison thing where they're just, like, digging out characters to bring them into a book. Like, I mean, that's fine. I have no understanding of who any of those characters are, so, I mean...
Well, Sergeant Rock
sounds fun for you.
He's been in a bunch of stuff. He goes back to, we've talked about DC and War Comics and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he had an ongoing arc in Men of War before that book got ended. Mm-hmm. Robot Man's actually been in Justice League, though. I don't know if you've read those issues. Paul,
no, I haven't. I didn't realize that. Doom I didn't Patrol's think any of the Doom Patrol guys had shown up. Okay.
Yeah. Huh. No, the team is featured very prominently because they... this would be the most recent trade, because I read Justice League in trade. Power Ring, okay. Kind of the girl or whoever, I guess technically she's called Power Ring, I suppose. The new Power Ring obviously doesn't know how to handle the ring, and she gets really unstable, and the Justice League tries to basically control her, but the Doom Patrol shows up first and tries to set mm-hmm. things straight to mixed results. So actually, if you were looking to get your fix of Doom Patrol, you need to go back and read. It would have been the arc before Fabic took over with the whatever the virus arc was with Fabic. This would be the arc.
Oh, the Amazo virus. Okay. Yep.
Yes. This is yeah. Okay. So
I love the Doom Patrol. So yeah, I'm gonna have to check that out.
Yeah. There you go. So what about you, Mike? What's your pick for this week?
Well, I don't know how this has happened, but I think I've picked this book almost every month. It's a DC book because all my Marvel books are gone. Actually, I was just looking at the pull list while you guys were talking, and I was like, I know that October is the scary month for my wallet because all the X-Men books are coming back, and Jeff Lemire is writing a bunch of them, and that's like, I'm really worried about myself. Like, Mike is going to have some serious financial problems, I think. but this was not the week. I have a feeling that it's either next week or the week after is going to be very dangerous in terms of X-Men books. But nonetheless, this week I am picking Constantine the Hellblazer number 5. This book continues to be incredible and amazing and everything that I didn't know I wanted about a Constantine book. And I keep, every time I read this book, I'm like, I gotta go back and read old Hellblazer. And then I go, that's a lot of fucking comic books. Maybe not.
Some of which aren't that good.
Yeah, so I take what I can with this, with the Constantine the Hellblazer. But this book is every month just delivering the weird magic, crazy shit that I love about this character. Like, in my head, I have this caricature of who Constantine is, and for some reason, somehow, this book is just that perfect portrait. So this book is stellar, art stellar. I meant to go get this book signed by Riley Rossmo, who was at New York Comic Con, and James Tynion. But I hadn't seen, like, every time I walked by their booth, like, I went by their booths a bunch of times and they just weren't there. So I think it's just an unfortunate circumstances where I just didn't happen to cross paths with them. But nonetheless, I mean, this book is stellar. I think this is, if anybody's looking for a cool Hellblazer book, like, this is the one. And I recommend it to anyone who wants to just read an offshoot on its own DC book. And I know we've said a million times this doesn't tie into anything, but that makes it work really well for someone who doesn't read a lot of DC. So I'm loving this book. I think, Nick, you said you're reading this book as well, I believe.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I reviewed, I think, the first two issues a couple of months back. And, yeah, I was worried when Rossmo left, but I really like how they've managed with Vanessa Del Rey to sort of, again, set up that dichotomy of two artists doing past and present. And so I think you've got, if I remember right, it's Del Rey doing the present. And then I know for at least one issue, they actually had Ming Doyle, the writer, actually doing the past.
For the flashback episode, or not episode, issue that they did, where there were things going on and there's parallelisms between the past and now and all that jazz.
Yeah.
Because ghosts are getting killed and it's the coolest story. You could, I don't know, I'm so in love with this ridiculous, out there, unexplainable suspense story that they're throwing at us. It's good.
And I just love it because you can tell that this is pretty close to as a mature comic as I think DC is comfortable with doing. And I think that's great in my mind because I know there are things that I read in this issue and I'm like, man, I wonder how this got past, you know, some of the old guard that are like, well, we can't talk about that, or, you know, gee, I feel uncomfortable that Constantine is talking about being attracted, you know, to this other guy in the room, and he's like, oh, that guy's hot, you know, so.
Yeah. It's diversity, man. I mean, there's a whole thing behind that. Actually, I read an article about that and how there's a lot of people out there who are really excited because apparently I think Tynion is I think he's bisexual. So there's a lot of people who are like really excited that they're writing Constantine is like with a, I don't want to say bisexual background, but like a queer background in terms of his sexuality. Like he's really like,
which is weird because like he's basically, they're writing him the way he was in Hellblazer. So
yeah.
It's like,
yeah. And that's what people are really excited about it. Like,
isn't it great that you're doing it how it used to be? But I it's great that they're honest to the character. Yeah. Mainly because with Constantine, not Constantine the Hellblazer, but with Constantine, the first New 52 book, correct me if I'm wrong, it never wanted to touch that topic.
No. Well, they didn't even have time to like delve into that with him as a character. Like they talked about a little bit of romantic past, but it was nothing that was like a major part of the story like this.
Right.
Like,
well, they were too busy making it a visual magic action book, so they had no time for downtime anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Ugh. So I'm, again, really excited about this book. This is like one of the best books I'm reading right now, hands down.
Absolutely.
So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about being mean about comic books. No, that's not true. We're going to talk about judging comic books sometimes and how, you know, before a book comes out, we get a little upset and we don't know why. So we'll be back in a quick second to talk about that.
Those of you that tuned in and listened to our episode last week know that we started a conversation around Dark Knight 3, the upcoming book by Frank Miller, Brian Azzarello, and one of the Kuberts, Andy or Adam, I think. Can't remember which one. But we didn't want to talk about the book again, but it was difficult not to because a lot of the announcements about the book that came out during the New York Comic Con last weekend raised larger issues about the way comic books are marketed these days. So this is a book that doesn't come out until November 25th. Another month or so from now, but we've already seen dozens of variant covers. We've seen some interior artwork, and just think they've introduced the uninked interior artwork, then the inked interior artwork, and then some, maybe we'll get some colored pages. So the way the book is being presented is piecemeal, giving us a little bit at a time. So by the time the book comes out, we'll maybe have already seen enough till we're sick of it. So why do publishers, and why is DC in, specifically right now, marketing this book this way? Is it a smart way to do it, or is it going to sort of spoil the book before it even comes out?
I don't know if this is specifically a DC thing, but I obviously, you know, DC is doing a lot. So, I mean, I think to speak to that in particular, I think the worry is, you know, when they first announced this book, you know, it was Dark Knight 3, The Master Race, and everyone went, what the fuck? What kind of Nazi shit is this, right?
And I was like, wait, oh my gosh, this is, oh, Frank Miller. Okay, all right.
Yeah, and so I think their worry is that the hype is going to go away for this book. Even though I can't fathom,
I can't imagine
why
how.
It would, yeah. but I right. think that they're worried that it's gonna fall out, like Marvel is gonna announce something crazy, like, because I mean, this book's gonna be coming out right near the end of Secret Wars, which is probably gonna be a big thing, and Marvel's been dominating like crazy with Secret Wars, but I mean, specifically, I mean, I'm speculating on a lot of this.
Star Wars,
Star Wars is coming out. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. Marvel has a lot in their court to give them the advantage right now, and this I think is like a. It's an easy win for DC, but I think they're probably playing it. They're probably trying to play this so that they don't fall out of the spotlight. Like they're giving us little bits and pieces just so that we're constantly reminded, oh my gosh, I can't believe they're doing this with the Dark Knight 3. And we just get, we go crazy over it. Like I feel like I've seen just like rabid comments on the internet of people, I can't believe Superman's dick's hanging out in this cover. Like, I don't know. I mean, that's not the case.
You did read my article.
Yeah. I mean, that was the craziest part. I mean, I don't want to like dive straight into the talk about that cover, but like just the number of people that have gotten so upset about this book. It's like, you guys, it's not even out yet.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's really interesting because we kind of see the same thing going on with just the way movies are marketed now, where there's so much speculation what the movie's going to be. We don't really have... it's not like you're forced to form an opinion, but you feel obligated to form an opinion before it even comes out. And that's what I feel like they're doing.
How often do you go to someone and say, hey, have you seen the fourth trailer for Star Wars yet? You know, yeah, or have you seen the interior pages for Dark Knight 3 yet? Like, you push this around to say, like, you know, I've already formed an opinion. I want to hear what you have to say about it. But why do we do that? You know, that I think that's, I mean, that's, to reiterate your point.
I do it as an excuse to push my opinion on other people. I really don't care what their thoughts are. But
thank you for being honest, Nick. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I guess if we are being very honest, I think a lot of the...
We're not being that honest, Paul.
Okay, scale sorry.
No, go ahead.
A lot of the quote-unquote outrage online is being done by sites trying to generate clicks. I mean, a lot of it does feel like, you know, clickbait.
Yeah.
But it's hard not to get caught up in that. You know, so when they did release the images for the variant covers that Miller did, I was like, well, these are kind of neat. You know, we haven't seen any new artwork from him for a long time. I know he did that Holy Terror book, but my understanding was that was basically sort of a finished book years ago before it actually came out.
Yeah.
So get new artwork from Frank Miller seems like an important idea or an important event. And because it wasn't what people expected, they just shat all over it. You know?
Yeah.
So it's like immediately you had to have an opinion on it.
I don't know if neat is the right word to say, but like it's exciting.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I dug it. I think it's awesome. I mean, my little aside here is that I think it's cool to see Frank Miller trying out different ideas at his age. You know, so many artists get stuck in their ways. To see a guy who's actually trying to be creative and push himself and channeling Jack Kirby, which is something he didn't really do that often in his other stuff, I think it's awesome. But the sort of vitriol, which with its attack was... It shouldn't have been shocking to me, given what I know about comic book fans on the internet, but it still was kind of shocking.
Yeah. And of course, this is a book coming out. I mean, to try to add some like societal context or I guess cultural context to it. Like, this is a book that's coming out side by side with probably one of the better Batman runs in a very long time, right? So to say like, hey, we're going to launch another key humongous. I mean, and I know that there's a handful of other Batman books out, but I think, you know, Snyder's run with Capullo on Batman is probably going to go down in history as one of those like killer books that you should have read. You know, like, this is going to be another Grant Morrison's Animal Man, or this is going to be another Grant Morrison's New X-Men. I can only think of Grant Morrison books for some reason. You know, but like one of those longer run series, you know, that people go back and say, man, remember how good this was, you know, 10 years from now. And then to see The Dark Knight, which, what, you know, at the time, like I think we said last week, Dark Knight came out, it was instant classic. Now we're like using nostalgia to say, hey, look, here's another, you know, Batman, or another installment in that series. I remember how much you loved that. And it's so vastly different than what we're used to right now that I think people are just attacking it simply because it's different. You know, I, or at least that's my thought on it, you know.
Classic books like, you know, the original run of The Dark Knight Returns or Watchmen, which I guess are always the go-to examples, or even Year One by Frank Miller. Those books were surprising because they seemed to come out of nowhere. I mean, hindsight's 2020, so I'm sure there were house ads for those books in the comics themselves, but we didn't have this sort of 24-hour instant access information, this social media. So now there's not really a way for books to be surprising. And it's almost like DC's taking away, or DC and Marvel at times, the big two, take the opposite approach where they oversaturate the news cycle with previews, which makes it very hard to stay excited about a book. I don't know.
Yeah, at this, at some point, does it feel like sensory overload for a book like this? And it not just this book, but any book that that a company, like whether it's Marvel, DC, Dark Horse, Image, anybody, that they're trying to hype so much that it's in every aspect of social media. Like, you'll see emails about it. Like, I don't know about you guys. I subscribe to like almost all of the comic publishers' newsletters just to get information, because I follow previews, but I also want to, like, you know, keep up just in case I miss something, or, you know, catch an interview that I may have missed. So when you see these publishers pushing books on you like that, do you almost have that, like, asshole mentality of, like, well, this seems like it's going to be way too cool, I shouldn't read it? Like, and maybe that's what people are thinking, like, this Dark Knight thing was going to be really cool, but now it's in our face all the time, everyone's going to know about it. I don't know. Maybe I'm going in a weird tangent with this. Nick, you haven't said anything about this. I'm like,
sure, maybe I'm so that's scared. A good thing. No, no, I've been taking notes, and I'm going to unleash. No, it's honestly, I sort of have the reverse approach with Dark Knight 3. I don't really, in some weird ways, I don't think they're maybe 100% confident that this book is going to actually do amazingly well. I think it's going to do well, but I think you have to remember, in lieu of DCU and the New 52 and this concern about giving readers a new jumping on point and maybe going after younger readers or new readers, which all of the statistics will tell you those people don't exist and have never existed, whatever. I'm half joking. I mean, they'll tell you that all the time. And new readers aren't a thing, and you're wasting your time looking, you know, trying to attract them. But I honestly feel like Dark Knight 3, it of course assumes that people have read the other two, and or at least consumed them in some way, and I don't think, I mean, this is coming from someone, I mean, here's my big reveal, I haven't read either of them, and I mean, I read Hush, so I figure I'm set. I'm just kidding. But I can only assume that this book is not going to be friendly at all to someone who hasn't read the other two. Maybe they're making this push real hard right now in hopes that people are up to date, or if they make a big enough push, people like me, who haven't read either of the two, will at least say, well, let's at least ignore comic history and just think in a delusional state and hope that if I frame this and put it on my wall in 20 years, this will be worth just as much as whatever I assume the single issues of Miller's other two, you know, books are worth in this franchise. So I actually think in some ways they're nervous that this book might not be as approachable or quote unquote have a great new jumping on point or anything like that. And then, of course, beyond that, I think maybe because we don't love, maybe there's not as much universal love for Frank Miller as there once was, or maybe there never was. But if we take it out of Frank Miller and just say, how big of a deal would it be if Alan Moore went back and did Watchmen again, or how huge of a deal would it be if, you know, he went back and did V for Vendetta or something like that? Like, that's clearly what this book is. I mean, it's a big deal. And, of course, Frank Miller, I don't need to tell you guys, but I'm sure some of our listeners maybe aren't aware, while they've never been super forward about it, and you know what, it's Frank Miller's business, so it's none of my business, but it doesn't take a genius to know that Frank Miller hasn't been doing real well the last couple of years, health-wise, and so the idea that we're actually getting something is amazing. Even more amazing. regardless of how you feel about him or his work.
So that's interesting, Nick, because that idea of it being an event in some sense, you know, an established legendary creator's coming back, that should sell itself. So it does seem strange that DC's in, like, you know, hyper mode, publishing the pushing the book, advertising it. It almost feels, you suggested, almost like a little disingenuous. Like, they kind of know this book might not be as good, or I don't want to say good, but may not be as successful as we're hoping. So we're trying to make sure people feel that it's important, even though, well, like you're saying, it should kind of sell itself, you know?
Yeah. Maybe they're like, shit, we've commissioned how many variant covers now? How much is that going to cost us? It's going to cost us that much? Oh, yeah. Damn it.
So it's hard. It's hard.
Call the people at Diamond.
scale back. Sorry. but it's hard to, you know, not be critical of that. It's hard to not be cynical when you see that level of hype and advertisement. Do you think that's why we see these big books like this sometimes get a negative response? Is it just people are super cynical these days? Well, or, you know, is it something innate in comic book fans to just be pissed off all the time for no reason?
I don't believe it's that. I think it's strictly because it's Frank Miller. I think we're looking at, like, a lot of people have been watching this guy. I mean, the guy's been in the industry for a really long time. Mm-hmm. I don't see people freaking out about this when Chris Claremont jumps on a new book, and the guy's been in the industry much longer. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who don't know who he is, this is Chris Claremont's one of those guys that wrote some of the most classic X-Men that shaped and reformed, like, the X-Men universe over you know, the course of the late 80s and early 90s. And I mean, the guy's still writing comic books to this day. But we don't see this much hype around a book or anything like that. And I mean, maybe because he's not bringing back...
Controversy is the right word.
Yeah, controversy. Yeah, yeah. So maybe it's because he's not doing something like he's bringing back a classic character. Like, if he were to come back and write another Dark Phoenix saga, I'm sure there would be guns and fireworks and all sorts of, like, rampaging fans trying to fight each other about who thought it was great or who thinks it's going to be great and who doesn't. But I don't know. I think that maybe it's just people are... They didn't like Dark Knight when it came out, or just news websites are presenting it in, like, a certain way that's just causing people to not feel great about this. And I have to wonder, like, when have we seen the opposite of this? When have we seen, like, a big writer come back or a big artist come back and do something great, and everyone was like, oh my gosh, this is going to be the greatest thing in the world? Because I can't think of that many. Like, maybe when Astro City came back, and that's still ongoing, right? But
right, yeah.
I don't know. What can you guys think of any examples?
Well, I mean, I think it's hard to think of them because they're so rare. There always seems to be this strange pessimism that follows not just comic culture, but a lot of sort of insular pop culture. There's immediate sort of inclination to be sort of cynical that something can't be that good. You know what I mean? There's got to be some problem with it. You know, I admit I've had that reaction to stuff too. You know, the critical success of Sex Criminals, I read the first issue, I'm like, I don't think this is that good. And I felt strange saying that because it had such, I mean, I went back and thankfully I went back and read more of it and I was like, oh, I was wrong. But it's weird that my sort of initial gut reaction was to be like, oh, nothing that popular can be good. You know?
Yeah.
So maybe that says more about me than comic fans in general, but it seems to be a pretty common response.
Yeah. I mean, I trying to think, like, Brian K. Vaughan is the first person that comes to mind when I think of, you know, super popular books that are really, really hyped. And I know in the pre-show we had talked about, and I mean earlier in the show, we talked about Paper Girls and how how great that number one was. And
but because it was a surprise.
It was a surprise. And I think I don't remember that book being so overhyped. Like, I know that there was a lot of word about it, and it was kind of one of those things where, and I believe I mentioned this in another episode, that, you know, they announced this book like a year and a half ago or almost 2 years ago or something, and now it's finally coming out, and that's awesome. But up until that point, I don't think we really saw anything. Like, maybe we saw a cover, and I think we got a preview the week before it came out, but there was no other hype. And maybe this is a little bit different in terms of, like, this isn't a classic book being brought back to life. This is a brand new series, and it's Image, and Image does things differently. But I don't remember there being, despite that, these are, you know, Cliff Chiang and Brian K. Vaughan are two very, very popular creators, and I don't remember there being a lot of negative feedback about that book.
You know, yeah, that's what's interesting about it is that the creators there are going to attract a knowledgeable audience, whereas the big two are obviously going to try to get as many people to read as possible. That's why their marketing seems to be geared toward nostalgia. I mean, does anybody really think the original Secret Wars was good at all? Why does it keep coming back as something we're supposed to be excited about, you know?
Yeah, I admittedly, I've never read the original Secret Wars. Right. And I'm only reading the current Secret War book. Well, I guess the original book was called Secret War, and this one is called Secret Wars, plural. So, I mean, Dr. Doom, that's all I care about. I'm reading it because Dr. Doom, but that's just me. But even still, when that book was coming out, I remember before it came out, there was a lot of press around it, and everyone was like, why are you bringing back this stupid thing? It was something that happened a long time ago. Dead means dead, and, you know, and then they brought back, like, all the other different crossover events, and it was met with all sorts of negative hype from me included. I mean, I was one of those people, and I guess it's a weird phenomena to say, you know, why, when something comes back that's popular, something that gets super hyped, why do we just suddenly have this cynical, negative view about it? I mean, that's like a bigger cultural question, you know?
And I mean, it's not a negative. It always seems cynical or negative, but it's not coming. I mean, it's a cynical or negative reaction, but it's not usually coming from a cynical or negative place. It's usually coming from a sense of concern for something's legacy. And so I think with with Dark Knight 3, people's reactions might be, you know, cynical or like, oh my gosh, what's going on? But I guarantee you with a lot of them, it's this concern that for as much as some people might claim, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. Dark Knight 3, this is amazing. We're going to get another chapter. There's this, you know, anxiety that, well, what sort of place and state of mind is Frank Miller in now? And how is it going to be with him coming back to this character after so long? And how is this going to jive with some of the more progressive social ideas and notions being espoused at DC right now? And how well is this going to be received by a bunch of these new 52 sort of people? Or are those people even going to care? But it's a question of legacy in a lot of ways. And I'm certain it's the same thing that would happen if Alan Moore ever went and did Watchmen 2, which I just described the most unlikely event to ever happen. So,
well, yeah, you remember, Nick, when before Watchmen came out, and then your copy of Watchmen on the shelf faded away like Marty McFly's picture, right? It just disappeared.
Crispin Glover appears.
Yeah. Oh, what happened?
Sorry, I'm losing my shit over here right now. Sorry, keep going, Paul.
Well, that was the joke. But you know, I think that's such an interesting concern that we just see in pop culture in general. Is like, oh no, there's going to be Lady Ghostbusters now. The original Ghostbusters are, you know, doomed. Like, what? No, the movie still exists. You can go watch it anytime you want.
But no one wants to be fucking honest about it. No one's going to be like, you know what, guys? I'm just really worried. No one wants to be that guy who's like, you know, being sensitive. And it's like, you know what? I just love this so much and I'm worried. No one's like that.
Well, I think there are, you know, I actually disagree with you. I think there are people. I think there are people out there who are saying that, but they're coming at it with the wrong tone, I guess, which is a weird way to say that. But they're coming at it with like, I'm really worried about this. They're and then it always is followed by because they're gonna ruin it, and like what that implies,
phrase that is.
Yeah, it means so many things, like that you don't trust these creators, you don't trust these actors, you don't trust the direction of the storytellers. And as much as I don't like defending trilogies and like extending series, there's something to be said about trying something new with an existing world. Like, they've been doing this type of stuff in comics for forever. For a long time, at least. They've been, you know, telling Ghostbusters stories or telling Star Trek stories or telling any other licensed property stories. And, you know, like, Star Wars Extended Universe is like a perfect example of that, where they did a lot of things right and they created something that could have never been done in film. And people loved those characters. And so when they all disappeared with the new Marvel, this is a brand new canon, there were people up in arms about it. They're like, where's Mara Jade? Where are all these characters that I fell in love with and I devoted so much time to? And those characters could have never been created had, you know, the creators actually taken a chance and said, all right, we're going to go with this new direction. We're going to try something that exists in this universe and extends it.
We're not going to drop a planet on Chewbacca.
Yeah. I mean, and Dark Knight feels to me like, yes, it's the third chapter in the trilogy, but maybe it's just like another... It's an extension of the story, and I'm hopeful. Like I really enjoyed the original two books, and now I'm excited for this new one because I'm just excited for one, more Frank Miller book, and two, more Batman Dark Knight. Like that shit is super cool Batman to me, and maybe I'm jaded. I don't know, and maybe it's gonna be awful, or I have this weird image in my head about those books. But I'm gonna definitely go back and reread them. I'm looking forward to this. I don't have this negative purview, so I don't know. Maybe that's just
me. I think that means you're not jaded. I think if you're like legitimately excited about something, like that seems kind of rare these days, and it means like you're not jaded. You're not cynical, you know. So
thank you for validating me.
Yeah, you know, I've reached a point where I'm old enough. I'm not going to be embarrassed by my taste, and I'm like, if I like something, I like it. There's no irony involved or anything. So if I could kind of draw these different threads together, hopefully to kind of tie it up a nice little bow here,
sure,
this big discussion, and get your sort of final thoughts maybe. So there, it seems like not just in comic books, but in pop culture, very insular, I hate the term nerd culture, but insular pop culture groups like this, there is a value placed on the idea of ownership maybe. Like if you discover something, it's important to you and it means a lot to you. That's why you love it. And when that excitement for something feels manufactured with oversaturation and hype, that kind of kills it. And then when something you love gets remade, it's easy to feel like as like it's an assault, even though the thing you love still exists. So when we have books like this that oversaturate advertisement, it can be easy to be cynical. And the counterexample are books that, like Paper Girls, like Saga, like, you know, Hawkeye, books that seem to come out of nowhere, even though they didn't, they were advertisements for them. But there's a sense of ownership and discovery with them because they weren't sort of just plastered everywhere. Is that safe to say, maybe, the difference between those two approaches in advertising?
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing is a continuation of an existing story, or like a rewrite of an existing story. I think like it goes back to the point of your feeling like your love of the original story or the previous story is being assaulted. You know, I really like that. I like that phrase or that idea of like your ownership is being devalued because there's something new and maybe people will like that more than what was originally there. And that's why we stick this, well, you didn't read the old stuff. You didn't read the original kind of mentality sometimes. You weren't there. And
when I was reading a book.
That seems like just a silly reaction, but it's one that I think it's very easy to fall into, oddly enough. Yeah.
I think in a weird way, if this, not to stomp all over that ending, but I think in a weird way, I think if Frank Miller or someone else was reinventing or riffing on his two previous installments, I think people would be less anxious. But the fact that it's a follow-up, I don't know. I mean, comics have always been a reflection... Good comics have always been a reflection of the times in which they were made and the social and political discourse going on at the time. And at least for me, and of course this is someone who doesn't read much Frank Miller and someone who hasn't read the other two installments, so how invested am I truly? But for me, being someone who thinks about comics critically, I would be a little bit worried that because it's a follow-up and because of Frank Miller's attitudes over the last couple of years, I would perhaps be concerned that maybe this book is going to feel like it's trapped in the decades in which the previous installments were made. And maybe this won't be as reflective of current issues or times. And so I guess that would be the biggest concern for me. And then, of course, the smaller side note for me, which maybe some of our readers know this, some of them don't. If Scott Snyder was still attached to this, I would feel a little bit better about maybe things not veering off into, I don't know what you want to call it, interesting places. But the fact that Snyder's not attached anymore, that does make me a little bit more concerned. And it's not to say that Azzarello's a bad writer, but he's not really my cup of tea either.
It's almost as if you're taking a level-headed approach to this book, Nick. And that's obviously not what we should be doing. I want like a gut reaction of what, do you going to buy it or not right away, right? Form an opinion.
Exactly. don't judge a book by its cover. We've heard that a lot on those The More You Know things from NBC and all those other public service announcements that tell us that we need to recycle and stop staring at the sun during those eclipse thingies and all the other things that they fill us in on. But we've somehow disagreed with this notion that we can't judge a book by its cover. In fact, I think all of us are guilty of just looking at something and saying, you know what, I have to have that. Here's my money. I realize this is a book, but I'm not even going to open it before I give you my cash. And oddly enough, I think for at least for me, some of my most pleasant reads have been these books that have been impulse buys. And perhaps this ties into our discussion earlier about with books being pushed on us so much and this idea that we need to be hyper-informed before we pick something up or read it or whatnot, that there's some joy to be had and just looking at something, saying, man, that art looks good, and just buying it. And maybe that harkens back to like being 6 or 7 and, you know, going to the comic rack and being like, this one looks cool. What about you guys? Have you done this? Have you not done this? Are you going to point out to me that this is a really weird and stupid way of doing things, or what?
Not well, Nick, I have to say, I have to say that you are out of your mind, and I only buy books based off of pure research. No, I
super
actually,
informed. Goodreads ratings.
Yeah.
Amazon.com.
I actually, I mean, I've done this probably more often than I think. Like, I guess a lot of the times I'll walk into a comic shop and I'll see a graphic novel a lot of the times. And graphic novels are pretty hard to page through and just, like, judge based on, like, a cursory glance. So a lot of times I'll just simply look at a cover. If the title sounds interesting, if the synopsis on the back sounds interesting, I'll just pick it up. Like, for instance, the one that I did had this happen to me recently with was a series called Fontaine Bukowski, which is a very strange Fonte, I guess, maybe, I don't know, it's F-A-N-T-E, so Fonte Bukowski. It came out earlier in August of this year, and it was a book that I had seen the cover of probably like 10 times. Like, I saw it on Comixology, I think I saw it in a previews book. It's a Fantagraphics book, and so when I was at Bergen Street Comics when Paul was visiting New York City for a little while, we went down to Bergen Street Comics and I grabbed a copy of Capra, and then I also grabbed this book just on a whim. And there's on the cover, there's just like an angry looking guy with a beard, and I'm like, hey, I can relate to that because I have both of those things in my life, in that I am an angry guy with a beard. So I picked up this book, and it was this very strange fictional story about this guy who was going crazy trying to write stories. And it's real short. It was, I think, $18 for this little tiny book, but it was well worth the purchase. It's just something I picked up on a whim. And I think whenever I've done that with single issues, I'm usually pretty pleased. And I think that's because over the years, I've come to realize that there are way more good comics out there than bad comics. So taking a risk on something like that, simply based on the cover of a book, is usually pays off more often than it doesn't. Or maybe I'm just very lucky, like super incredibly lucky.
Well, no, I think there's something to that, and I have plenty of examples that are similar because, like I mentioned, I go to the library a lot, and the library can be overwhelming because there's just such a variety of stuff. I just kind of grab random stuff. Sometimes you grab two books about, you know, the author's masturbating just on a whim, but sometimes you find stuff that's really great. But the reason that I think works more often than not.
I was going to say what exactly were on the covers of those books, Paul?
Let me see. I have them here on the shelf. Let me grab them real quick.
Oh boy.
They're not graphic.
Novels.
Well, the cover of Spent is an illustration of the author laying face down in his bed and his bed surrounded by Kleenex. That okay. Maybe should have been a tip off. And the Playboy is just a nice illustration of the author as a teenager standing in looking wistful in a field. So
okay. There's no clear indication.
But the reason I grabbed these books is because the artwork looks interesting. And we're talking about comics, and they're inherently a visual medium. So if it's an art style that attracts your eye, chances are you're going to like the book, or at least like, you know, reading it, looking at it. And the examples I have are of that. You know, I remember being in the library and grabbing the first volume of Stray Bullets because I thought the cover looked cool. It's this weird noir sort of evocative image. I know I've grabbed the Optic Nerve, the Adrian Tomine series. I grabbed that from the library because I like the cover so much.
That's a book I've seen so many times on the shelves, and I'm like, just do it. Just do it.
What
just
the heck is that book?
It's sort of like, you know, an ongoing sort of indie serial that's been... I read the first volume years and years ago, and I couldn't tell you exactly what happened in it. It wasn't quite my cup of tea story-wise, but the artwork was just lovely.
Yeah, the art looks fantastic on that book. It's unbelievable, especially the covers. The covers draw you right in. That's like problematic for your wallet sometimes. I mean, when you're buying things on a whim.
Well, you know, because I get this a lot. It's very similar. I buy a lot of records, and going to the record store and just buying stuff because you like the cover. You know, it's very easy to do. It's just that aesthetic, immediate sort of thing. Like, yeah, that looks cool. I think the last time it happened for me, I was in a comic shop. And I was just waiting in line, and I saw it on the shelf. It was the book Babies in Black by Arnie Belstorff. It's a book about the Beatles, and the cover was nothing special. It just said Babies in Black. I'm like, oh, that's the name of a Beatles song. And I picked it up, and the blurb on the back says a book about the Beatles when they were in Germany. I'm like, all right, sold. It's a comic about the Beatles. I can't not buy it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that immediate gut reaction, 9 times out of 10, turns out you can judge a book by its cover. What about you, Nick? Any examples you can think of?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for me, probably one of the ones that's more so had a really large impact on what I read and what I like is, I think one time Jordan and I were at Barnes & Noble, and I was just looking for a book to read. Like, I was like, you know what? I'm caught up on this. Yeah, I have Green Lantern Volume 3, so there's nothing to read here. And I'm just like, you know, it's one of those moments where you're embarrassed to say, like, I just want to get a book. And it's like, I don't really care. Like, I need something to read. Because all of my, you know, things where I normally check off the box and I'm like, yep, I've got that volume. I was all set, but I was like, I still need to spend money and be a good capitalist, and maybe that's what was underpinning everything. Maybe that was really it. It was one of those moments where it was like, you really don't need to spend money, but you're going to. And oddly enough, I ended up finding. So I was like, there's nothing in here over here in the DC that really, like, I feel like haven't already read or want to read. So I was like, we're gonna go into uncharted territory. And I don't know if you've ever seen, like, the Valiant books have a very different looking spine than most other publishers, or at least they were before they just switched it like a half year ago. But it's like these very pure white minimal spines. And I was like, what the heck is this? So I just started leafing through those. And I was like, oh, this is volume 3. This is like Bloodshot volume 6. And he looks kind of weird and whatever. And then finally I landed on Unity volume 1. And I look at the cover and you've got this floating guy in the background in this like suit, and I'm like, what the fuck? And then there's this other guy in the front with like this cloak on, and he's got like a shotgun and a sword, and there's like a purple ninja in the background. I'm like, what is going on here? What this is weird.
That's the best like, kind of cover.
Yeah, I was like who put these people together? It's like they like grabbed a whole bunch of characters from other comics and just slammed them onto a team. And I was like, I'm going to read this. And so I read Unity Volume 1, which I think I've talked about this before, but that was probably the absolute worst place to ever consider starting Valiant, because, like, this was like, you know all these characters and see them together. And I'm like, I don't know who these guys are at all. What's going on? So,
you kept reading, though.
Yeah, well, it was a. I mean, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a Doug Brathwaite cover, and it's just. I don't know if you've seen Doug Brathwaite's art before, but it is unlike anybody else's art. It is distinctive as hell, and it catches your eye completely. So, that was definitely one of them for me. What was kind of interesting that I was thinking about when you were talking about. Paul, when you were talking about what was that series? Something I or something like that.
Oh, Optic Nerve.
Yeah. And two things came to mind, which was first off, this idea of judging a book by its cover is a much more sound idea when it's graphic novels. Let me tell you. I mean, I'm sure you would agree completely. But it's like, you know what I'm saying? Because like with DC and Marvel, they're like, we are going to get some slick motherfucker to draw the best looking thing on the front. And guess what? That guy is going to have 1 month to draw that picture, and then another guy is going to have a whole month to draw all the stuff on the inside. So guess what? They're probably not going to look the same, and they're definitely not going to be drawn by the same guy.
Yeah.
Of course, that's not as true anymore. Not always. For example, Andrea Sorrentino did every cover for every, you know, Green Arrow book he was doing the interior artwork on, I think. But that sort of that theory came to mind, where it's like, yeah, judging a book by its cover, much more sound with graphic novels. But it also had me thinking about, have you ever not bought a book based on its cover? Because I have done that as well. And I will tell you what, every time I see a copy of Black Hole, I look at that cover and I'm like, this book looks like the most goddamn serious thing on the planet.
Oh,
like,
it is.
Good. It knows it's the most goddamn serious thing on the planet, and I shelve it immediately. I'm like, this book knows it's going to try to tell me something super fucking weighty about existence, and I just put it back.
Nick,
maybe I'm wrong.
You summed up that whole series right there.
Well, that's what I got from the cover. Every time I see it, I'm like, this book knows it's a big deal. It knows it's a big deal.
It doesn't help. I mean, it also helps that, like, the book is as thick as, you know, a telephone book, and it's a monster book. I mean, Paul, I think you were saying this. It's a fantastic read. Like, Nick is completely wrong. You should read that book. It'll change your life. Honestly, I wish that, like, 16-year-old me had read that book rather than, like, 23-year-old me, because I think it would have changed my world.
That's one of the books I remember when I got back into reading comics regularly again. That's one of the first ones I picked up. And
so you went for a deep dive then.
I was like, I saw it. I'm like, that looks fucking cool. And then again, an example of me like, say, that looks like a cool book. And every single person I've loaned it out to has loved it. So it's one of those books that somebody who doesn't normally read comics, I can give them that and they'll probably like it.
Yeah. But I can't say that I've ever said, this cover's so bad, I will not buy the book. I mean... Yeah, that's rare. I don't know. I'm probably of the opinion that, like, if I don't buy a comic book, it's, like, really rare. I don't know. If I have an interest in a book, the cover's not going to throw me. Yeah. Like, 9 times out of 10.
This is another interesting theory. I'm sure I've noticed this myself. Have you guys had books where you actually find the interior artwork to be much superior to the actual cover artist, and you're like, who picked this guy? Or, like, why would you do this? Like, the guy in the interiors is so much better.
That happens to me because sometimes, you know, my shop will pull variant covers for me.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And a lot of times when they're the themed variant covers, I'm like, fuck, I don't want Green Lantern on the cover of my Superman book.
You mean you didn't want the Lego variant of your Justice League?
Oh, Lego variant was great. Darwin Cook Month was great. DC is probably 50-50, I would say, with their themes. And I'm excited for Halloween month again. We'll see how that goes.
Sometimes it's fun, but sometimes I just want consistency. Like, if the variant is by an artist that's radically different from the normal cover artist, it can kind of throw it off. I just want that level of consistency.
I was pretty thrown by the 3D month at DC. Like, I was reading Swamp Thing, and I was kind of like, I'm really excited about this Arcane Villains month thing, but this cover is making me throw up. I don't know. Like, I couldn't deal with or maybe it wasn't Villains month. I think it was Villains month. For that, either way, I know Charles Soule signed that book for me, so it must have been
Villains Month.
I don't know. I can't say that that's happened to me very often, where I've been like, this cover is just god awful, but
because that's the purpose of the cover, you know. I mean, the cover. This is probably a larger conversation than we can do right now, but I feel like comic book covers for most of comic book history were designed to get you to buy the book because you didn't have pull lists or anything. It was just like, we got to convince people to put down their quarter and buy this book, you know?
Yeah.
And that we've gotten away from that. And now covers don't really serve that purpose, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be nice to kind of get back to that.
We talked about that.
Covers really got to stand out.
Way, way early on in the podcast. Oh, okay. I think one of our probably first 10 episodes, we talked about that, about how books are really trying to, I think that I actually think I disagree with you there, Paul. I'm going to disagree with both of you guys this week and be verbal about it.
That's a bad idea.
I still think there's a lot of covers out there that are trying to reel you in by the look of them. Like, you don't.
You're saying it's still a bait and switch sort of thing?
Not necessarily a bait and switch.
Maybe not as sinister as how it sounds when I say that, but.
Well, I think, like, you know, back in the day, it was, you know, the cover was like a weird way to draw you in, and there'd be like dialogue. And I'm thinking specifically like Marvel and DC covers, you know, when they were like, oh no, Nightcrawler's getting beat up by the man with the orange fist. What's going to happen? Find out inside. Like, you know, that they were, or like, it was a literal advertisement
Flash of Two
for the
Worlds
book
cover.
Yeah.
Always think of that cover. Always think of that cover.
The KFC cover that we were talking about. The KFC presents the Colonel of Two Worlds. That was an advertisement cover, which is like a throwback and making fun of that style. But that's totally what it is. It's an advertisement for the book rather than just being a...
And it worked.
Yeah, it worked on you. So, but nowadays, I don't see them so much as advertising, so much as I see them as like a quick display of what the book's about. Like, it's just like a blurb about the book rather than an advertisement trying to sell you the book. And so, based on that look, that's how they try to reel you in.
That's interesting. I mean, I was thinking about this the other day with the Fade Out. As much as I love that series, the covers have no bearing on the issue itself. Like, it's all the covers blur together for me. You know what I mean?
That's true.
Which also again, throwbacks to old like movie posters in some ways. Like, I don't know. At least that's how I feel about it. And it's not a direct correlation, but it feels like it's an old style of advertisement like they used to do for movies.
Yeah. But it doesn't really tell you what that particular issue is about. And I guess sometimes it'd be nice to see covers that reflect the interior story a little bit. That way, it might be. I'm still going to buy the comic if it's on my pull list, but it would help me remember the issue when I'm flipping through. I'm like, what happened to this issue? I don't know, because the cover is just like a nice, you know, portrait of somebody. Like, it's not, doesn't tell me what's in the issue.
So. Yeah.
Well, I think also with the Fade Out, it's harder to sort of encapsulate things versus like a DC book where like they'll put the current villain on the front and you're like, oh, he's fighting this guy. And he's like, well, I'm going to get him with my new bat device or whatever. And you're like, oh, okay. So that's what was going on. Whereas with something like the Fade Out, it's much more difficult to deliver. I would say it's probably more difficult to deliver those. Oh, that's right. This is what's happening. So, well, I guess I would ask you guys, like, what would you prefer? Would you prefer something that's like really going to reel you in and it looks super exciting or maybe like blown out of proportion? Or would you want someone who's actually probably the interior artist giving you a more, I don't want to say honest, but perhaps accurate representation? Because I'm both ways on this because, I don't know.
In some ways, I really enjoy when the cover artist is the same as the interior artist. But at the same time, like, I do enjoy a little bit of variety sometimes. Like, maybe this is just, you know, since we're so deep in this, you know, this medium, you know, we know that the interior artist isn't the same as the cover artist based just on the look alone. So when I see like, oh, look, there's a cool Alex Ross cover to My Amazing Spider-Man number one, I'm like, I know that Humberto Ramos is doing the interiors and this isn't even close to Alex Ross. But it's still nice to say, look at this cool cover, and then I know what the interior, like, it almost becomes so iconic for me that I remember what the issue is about after the fact. You know what I mean? Like, specifically, well,
it's almost like you're holding. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Mike.
I mean, I was going to say, specifically with Amazing Spider-Man, I know back when I was reading it way, way back before they rebooted it and renumbered it, or not rebooted it, but whatever, they were doing these portrait villain hero alternative months. And based on what the cover was the character that they were focusing on for that issue. So it was really cool. You got these very in depth, very well drawn, like, portraits of these either a hero or a villain. And it wasn't the same artist as the interior, because I think John Romita Jr. was doing the interior at the time. So it was like, these are definitely not John Romita Jr. covers. But they were still really cool. And I could say, based on this one, like, I think it was switching between Peter Parker every other issue, and then like Venom, and then Anti-Venom, and then one other villain, I don't remember. But each subsequent Peter Parker, he was getting more and more beat up as the arc was going on. So, like, because he was in the comic, Peter Parker was getting beat up as the comic went on. So I don't know. I really like that. But it's things like that, that like, when you look at them on the whole, you're like, wow, that was like a good progression or something like that. Almost telling like a weird little story, but maybe that's one-off. I think that happens way less often than like your standard cover.
Yeah, and I think that's something I would like to have more often, is not just reflect the interior, but to be sort of a part of the story. I know that's what Grant Morrison wanted for All-Star Superman. So each cover... it's very iconic and a striking image, and more or less functions as the first panel of the story. It's like this big, large first panel. And if you actually read them, that's kind of how it works. Like, it's kind of telling you what the story's going to be about before you even open the cover of the book, you know?
Yeah.
And it's hard to pull off. That's really hard to pull off.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg. This episode was produced by Mike Rappin, and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Cities of Eve, Capital Cities, Big Gigantic, and Infinity Shred. If you'd like to keep current with the I Read Comic Books podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And while you're there, take a quick moment to rate us. If you have a topic you'd like us to talk about, or if you just want to say hi, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythesybe.org. Also, feel free to shoot us a message on Twitter at @destroythesybe and follow us on Tumblr at destroythecyborg.tumblr.com. And as always, thank you for listening.
Did you guys have fun weekends? I feel like I just started rambling about NYCC and I was like, fuck you guys, I don't care what you did. I know, Paul, you said you chilled out at home and that's cool. But did you guys do any art prizing? Was that done this weekend? Oof. I don't know if it's over.
Yeah, this was the last weekend.
Yeah.
Anything good? Anything fun? Good call.
Same here. Yeah.
I went on Comixology last night and things got out of hand. That was my weekend. Things really got out of hand. Oh, man.
I feel like that's been happening more and more to you, Nick.
Yeah, I really need to shut down my account. I really do. Because last night I was like, fuck it. That's all of Essex County for like $5. So I bought that.
That's a good deal, though. That's, yeah.
Yeah, and I read about the first, oh, my goodness.
That's Greg Rucka, right?
I don't want to be a dick, but I'm sorry.
I'm thinking, he does an independent series. I know that's
Stumptown.
Jeff Lemire. Yes, I'm thinking of Stumptown. I don't know why.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah.
Maybe because it's another geographical thing. I don't know. This is Lemire. I read the first 100 pages without even thinking about it. Oh, my goodness. And, like, good God, it's like with an editor at DC, like I feel like the editor is like, you know what, we can't have all of this because you're going to make people really sad like all the time.
Yeah.
And then with Essex County, it's like, I'm going to make you feel terrible all the time. I'm not accountable to anybody. So it's like nonstop feels all the time. Yeah. And I bet if I was Canadian I understand like the cultural significance of...
You're close enough to Canada, man. It's fine.
Yeah. What is it called? Wednesdays are hockey night in Canada. That's what it's called.
Hockey night in Canada.
I get like how big of a deal that is. I do wonder how much maybe I'm missing. But yeah, I picked that up. And then I picked up this thing called Wool, which I guess is like a science fiction book that's really on the up and up now.
Yeah. That's like super promoted all the time on Comixology.
Yeah, but I saw that and it's like adapted by Palmiotti and Gray. And then I went on Goodreads and everybody who apparently read the original book was like, if you haven't read the original book, you're gonna be so confused. And it's more of like an outline because they only had like 6 issues and it's terrible. And I was like, whatever, I don't care, I'm on a roll. So I bought that. You can't stop me. It was like $2. I was like, whatever.
The only person that can stop you is Visa or MasterCard.
The only thing that can stop me is my bank. And then I was like, you know what? I really want to read Book of Death number 3, but it's like in the other room and my hands are like covered in like chocolate cookie crap. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. So I bought that too. It was a bad night.
Do I have to, like, write a letter to someone at Comixology and be like, this account needs to stop?
Between the hours of 11 p.m. and 2 a.m., please shut down Nick White's account. It's... You can't be left unattended. Or, like, every time I try to buy something, the little, like, one of those tech support windows pop up, and it's like, hi, my name is so-and-so. Should we discuss your purchases? So... But anyway, I mean, all that sounds awful, but all in all, I think I spent a grand total of like $10, which is unfortunately why this habit continues.
Yeah, because it's just $10 here, $4 mm-hmm. there. Who cares?
I'm not gonna add it up. You know who's gonna add it up? My bank is. But
yeah,
they're gonna be you know what? These when you put these numbers together. I'm like, what? Does it make Captain Planet? Is that like, I know when things combine, that's the usual result. They're like, no, it means you owe us more money. I was like, that's not fucking Captain Planet. Load of shit.